Frog Eyes, and I Walk Out of There from their album, The Open Up. You're listening to CJSF. Let's hear on the top of Burnaby Mountain.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious. Something mundane, something every day, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
Time now for Gardening with Embark. And joining me in the studio is Pablo Vimas, Gardens Manager for Embark Sustainability and our gardening expert.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Thanks for being here, Pablo. It's week 40.
Correct. Wow, the time has fly. We started in week 13 and now we are just thinking on closing the gardening season.
Mm-hmm. So it's really only 4, maybe 5 weeks left?
Yes. If the... The first frost delays a bit. We are talking about 5 weeks, but yeah, the first frost is in our minds, in our gardening minds, and it's time to start preparing our garden for the winter, mm-hmm. to put in the garden beds to bed.
Yeah. And we talked, you know, I mean, it's interesting because we sort of, even we talked about this before, how even in August we're starting to think about the end of the season because it's coming. I mean, obviously in August we're already at a point where we're a bunch of things we've planted in the spring are fruiting now and coming up for harvest, mm-hmm. but also sort of finishing their cycle.
Yes.
And then we sort of talk a bit about some other stuff we're doing to, you know, plants we can put in the ground now that'll come up next spring.
Next spring, yes. And as well to have plants that we put in for have a fall harvest. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and then we've been talking about what to plant, what to take into account, and how to care the garden. And now we're just in the last stretch. The weather has changed, as everybody noticed here in Vancouver. We are very much into a rainy period now.
Yeah, you can definitely feel how it's both cooler and wetter. You know, even 2-3 weeks ago, even when it was raining, it was still pretty nice. Yeah. Whereas now it's like, oh. Yeah, I can feel that chill in the air.
Yes, and then we know that the night temperatures are below 12 degrees. Yeah. So that also indicates that whatever plants that we have, like a lemon trees, if you have a lemon tree, a rosemary, mm-hmm. it's time to bring them indoors.
Yeah.
And if you want to have your lavender, you can take cuttings or bringing them inside. So all that activity is just towards like keep our plants going over mm-hmm. this long before the winter hits. So what happens in the garden at the moment is, yeah, with lots of rain. We are happy that no more watering. Mm-hmm. But now we are just keeping an eye on how much rain our garden beds are getting.
Yeah.
And then the next step is, if we are not going to cover with hoop houses, which is what usually we do, mm-hmm. it's time to start either planting a ground cover, mm-hmm. What we call the green manures. Yep. So any vegetable, a legume mainly, either clover or veg or fava bean mm-hmm. or peas, field peas, that we can plant in the garden, so they will grow over this winter, and then spring we will cut the tops and yep. mix that vegetation into the soil, so adding organic matter, right. adding nutrients. Very much use legumes because they have these characteristics of fixing nitrogen from mm-hmm. the air into the soil.
Right.
So we don't remove the roots, we just trim the plant at a root level, leaving the roots and the nodes in the soil,
yeah.
but we mix all the top, all the green leaves into the soil, and that adds organic matter. So that is one thing that we could do mm-hmm. with open garden beds, and yeah. as well we are now thinking mm-hmm, let's one more week perhaps, and then we are going to our hoop houses will be covered with plastic
yeah.
to keep to keep the rainfall, the excessive rainfall, mm-hmm. off from the garden bed soil. The other is the wind. If you notice, really windy these days. Yeah. With the wind is the leaves of the trees are falling. They are being fly all over the place. So wind, and the other is snow. Soon will be coming. Mm-hmm. Will come and frost. So these hoop houses protect the plants that we are growing over the winter for excessive rain, winds, and the frost.
So in your case, and I'm sure this is for many other gardeners, you're with the new garden placement, mm-hmm. You're much more exposed than you were before.
Correct.
So yes. What do you do to accommodate that? Because, you know, you used to be a bit surrounded by trees and stuff and on a bit of a slope.
Yes. So our previous garden location was, we had a building at the back and a small wood lot to the west of the garden. So that broke the wind, so it was very calm. But now we are in a really open space, and we have lots of wind. Because we just finished filling the garden beds with soil, so there's not much room, time for building hoop houses. So this year, we are going to do mulching and planting green manure crops. Yeah. Hopefully for the next year, we have the opportunity to put the hoop houses on. Again, we are trying to see a system that allows the snow to shed by itself. Because we have a system that's quite good, but when there's too much snow or wet snow, it just collapses. The whole garden bed just gets flattened.
Yeah.
So we like to come with another idea, to test another idea to see whether it works. And yeah, as well, the wind, our hoop houses need to be secure to the garden beds, because any hoop house will look like
catch a wind like a sail in a way.
Like a sail, and there it goes. So yeah, we need to find a way as well to secure the hoop house to the garden bed.
So what do you have in mind for that? Because like I say, I think a lot of people are with their gardens are going to be facing the same issues.
Yeah. So at the moment, what we have is in the student union garden, we have hoop houses in there.
Yeah.
So we are going to install our plastic covers.
Yeah.
And those as well, the rooftop gets lots of wind. So and those we've managed to secure the hoop houses into the garden beds by pressure. So we use lots of wood. The wooden frame, and when it gets wet, it swallows up.
Yeah.
So we just cut the wood to the dry size, and with the winter, all the wood swallows up and gets into pressure, expanded, and gets tight in the garden bed. So it's like, no wind is going to take it out.
Right.
Remove this. So we use plastic, but a very simple plastic. That's called heavy duty.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing heavier than that. Because if you use 5 mil or 6 mil, that's how the thickness of the plastic is measured. Yeah. It gets too hard to in order to tense it to tout.
Right.
That. So we just use a heavy plastic, which is enough for allowed us to tense. So the important is that the plastic has to be all tense all around the structure to prevent pockets. Because in those little pockets, water will accumulate, snow will accumulate, and that will be the weakest point to bring all the structure down.
Right.
1 year ago, we tried this wooden fleece. It's just a fabric like fleece that you put on top. But unfortunately, it tends to break very quick.
Right.
So after 2 months, it breaks into little pieces, and yeah, that's it. So we try to avoid that. We go straight.
So it just wasn't up to the weather.
Yeah, it's not up to the weather. Is this garden fleece is good for preventing insects that during the spring and fall, insects that goes into the plants and lay eggs, but nothing for the winter. That I won't recommend that using for overwinter your crops.
Right. So we have just a few weeks left, and we've got some stuff in the ground. What are you harvesting before the season's over?
All right. So today we finished removing all the tomato plants.
Okay. Yeah.
So tomato plants are done. What we came across, some tomato plants have caught the blight, and as well, some of the tomato fruits have black spots on the top.
Yeah.
So as well, we decide not to keep those because the blight is a bacterial disease, which will rot in the tomato if you bring that inside. So that goes to a different container, not the composter, because the seeds on those fruits are viable. So if we put in the composter, next time that we are harvesting, we are going to have lots of tomato plants.
Yeah, you're
going to
be spreading tomato plants all over your garden.
So what we did is collect all the tomatoes, all the plant material from the tomatoes, and put in a different container to be taken away from off campus. So we are doing that. We are removing any other plant that is infested. So we were today surprised that there are lots of white flies and eggs or white flies in the carrots, even through the leaves and the root. So we remove all that. There is black aphids in cabbages, in the nasturtiums as well. We collect all that, and no, it goes to the compost, but it goes to another different bin to be taken. So at the moment, it's like thinking, do I keep these plants knowing that they are infested? If so, I'm helping to the aphids to stay there for the next season. So we are clearing everything that is infested and putting for taking away and loosening the soil. And we were able to come to find some in one of the nurseries here in South Burnaby. We have got some lettuce, purple broccoli, broccolis, cabbages. So we are planting that as small seedlings. On top of that, we are having what is the garlic. It's time to plant garlic, as well as some leeks.
And all those will go under the hoop houses for
all
the winter.
All of those go in the hoop houses over the winter. We might start some arugula. We know that this arugula doesn't mind the cold, but with 4 weeks, the seeds will germinate and the plant will be too small when the first frost comes. So it will be quite a risk. We are going to run the risk that they will die during the first frost. But yeah, let's see what happens. Sometimes it goes okay. Kale as well. We found some seedlings of kale. So yeah, happy that the season is finishing. It has been a very heavy season for the Embark garden. As I said, we've been building a new garden, moving it. And we are happy that finally that's all settled. And now we just planted for the winter. And let's looking forward for the next season.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining us here today, Pablo.
Yeah, Greg, thank you for having me. And opportunity to share all these experiences with the community.
Yeah. Pablo Vimas is the Gardens Manager for Embark Sustainability. How do people find out more about Embark and its programs?
So Embark is basically a student union here in Burnaby campus. You can look our work in our website, embarksustainability.org, or through our social media at Embark Sustainability.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us today, Pablo. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. We will talk to you again next week.
See you next week.
All right.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
And myself, I think God bless me that I'm survived today. When the shrapnel through my arm, some friend of mine died by shrapnel. My arm a lot of bleeding.
That's the voice of Kum Mem, who sometimes likes to be called Tom. He's a young man who works at the Siem Reap War Museum in Cambodia. I met him recently on a trip this past October. He's a landmine survivor, a war guide, and has a great sense of humor. He's one of my guests on today's show, where we're going to be talking about landmines, amputees, and issues faced by people living in the Global South. My name is David Peck, and welcome to CJSF. I've asked Noel Hutchinson to join us today for the show to tell us a little bit about his experience. He's the Executive Director for Asian Outreach International Canada. He spent a great deal of time in Southeast Asia and has a deep love and passion for the country of Cambodia. Noel?
When I first flew into Cambodia, mid-90s, I was actually quite unprepared for what I saw, for what I felt. It was shocking, to say the least. And I think the thing that was most compelling for me, it wasn't that I didn't understand poverty. We worked in very impoverished villages and communities in northern Thailand among the ethnic minorities and the hill tribes and things like that. But there was just something different about what I experienced in my first trip to Cambodia. And I think in many ways it prepared me for all of our involvement ever since that point.
And yet, now looking back, you can say I've been working in the country for how many years?
Oh, it's got to be approaching 20 years now. And really, it was what I experienced in that first 2 weeks in the country that were the seed and my motivation and this passion and heart for Cambodia that just grew out of what I saw there. There was this beauty about people. There was this resilience. There, in the midst of all this devastation, I think what captivated me was just something simple. Like if you wanted to take somebody's picture, they would just burst into these radiant smiles, almost like you care enough to notice me, to look at me. And I left the country really not wanting to go back in some senses. But then it wasn't long before it was like, man, I got to go back. And it was out of this that this huge passion and love for Cambodia just began to develop in my life.
After about a 20-minute tuk-tuk ride from the main center of Siem Reap, we landed at the War Museum, and I was actually there with a friend of mine, Sean Dell. We're currently filming a documentary movie about another war guide there in his life and how he's dealt with his past and so on and how he's building for a future. And it was then that we met Coom, or Tom, and I was immediately impressed by Tom's ability to connect. He was just such a deeply relational guy. He spoke great English. He had this beautiful smile and this great sense of humor, and it was there that we decided we need to interview this guy for a variety of reasons. Tom.
Oh, I lost my arm when I was 14 years old. That is a bad luck for me in my life, that we walked together with the friend in the field near the Thailand border, and we looking for scrap metal, and some friend, they found a mine. They don't know this thing is like a toy. They play them with a friend and explore. Some friend around close by, they die by shrapnel because many bleeding. They design landmine from, I know they're not killed, just wound injured. They say one injured fire, sick army here to take care. But my friend, bad luck, they die by bleeding far away from the hospital. And bad luck for me, my arm, left arm, a lot of bleeding. If happened today, I think my arm is fine. They can operation, take a shrapnel, save my arm. That time, some friend, they tried to save my life. They become a doctor. They took a small, tiny wire, metal wire, cutting my arm. No injection, no painkiller. And I remember they gave me smoking. Do you know ganja? Ganja like painkiller. They told me, they give to me to smoke. But I cough a lot. I give back to my friend, and my friend, they give back to me. They say more smoke because ganja like painkiller. And then make me very thirsty. I need to drink. I talk to them. Please give me water, please. They say, cannot get a drink. Yeah, get a drink, more bleeding. And my heart jammed because that time I had run fast. And I see some friend, they walking, they bring coconut fruit. In my mind, I think they let me drink the coconut juice. After they walking, come to me, I pass out. When I open my eye again, my older friend, he told me 3 9 already that I can't open my eye. When I see my arm gone, I'm always feel sad, little cry. One of my older friend, he say, don't cry, don't worry anything. He tried to tell me one day when I grow up, he say my arm will grow.
Karen Valley, the director of the War Amps Amputee Center in Ottawa, Canada, brings her helpful perspective as an amputee and a woman who has worked with the organization for over 20 years.
It's a challenge sometimes to define what disabled means. because you're trying to reconcile what your internal definition of versus where you are in society and what society's expectation is or their interpretation of the world, and what your interaction is with the world at that particular moment in time. You know, in my own personal experience, I've had great moments where I have felt anything but disabled, and then other moments where not having a second hand has truly been an insurmountable challenge. And so in that moment, if I was standing next to a peer, they with two hands would be able to achieve that, and I with one could not. So in that moment, the only thing that defined the difference that I could see would be the, you know, the lack of the second hand. And yet there are other things that I could do much better than a peer, regardless of the number of hands I have or that they have. So I think sometimes we attach labels to things because it's an easy category to put us in, but I don't think living with a disability is as black and white as that.
You know, here's a statistic in speaking about those with physical disabilities, that they figure there are still between 150 and 200 unexploded ordinances that go off every quarter in this country. So just coming alongside communities that are dealing with even the repercussions and the fallout from unexploded ordinances is huge.
But landmine victim like me or my friend, we had to get a job. One thing had to get the friend. Some Cambodian, they very look down the landmine victim. They hate the soldier. They say army is the killer. So they don't care which army good or bad, but they say army is the killer. Some people hate the army. People look down, they don't want to talk, they want to make friends with. And one more thing, had to get to school. Like we try to study too, but we have no government support us to the school. And had to get a job. Like many places before I work here, I try to get a job, guess how, hotel, a lot of places, they say, don't have both arms, cannot work. But I say, I can. But they say, no, cannot work. One time, real story, I tried to be a receptionist at one guest house. I say, I can. You know, I write CV to them. I got interview because I didn't tell them I'm missing arm. I got interview. I'm happy to go. They see me missing arm. They say, oh, sorry, I didn't say I lost arm. So they say, I cannot be a receptionist. I change my mind. I say, I can be a cleaner. I'm strong. But they say, no, one arm hard. So they didn't give me a job. And I try to be speaking English tour guide. That I told you it's can, because the rural government missing arm cannot be a tour guide. But I got hard brain. I don't want to be back on the street. We need to work.
The number of factors in a place like Cambodia that can come into play, often in culture that has those types of experiences with disability, those living with disabilities hide their disabilities or they hide themselves. And so society isn't exposed to it, doesn't see it, doesn't have experience with it, doesn't see the positives, the benefits of interacting with or knowing someone with a disability. We know Canadian culture that if you have a worker with a disability, they are often more loyal than another worker might be because it's been a challenge to get a job, and so that job is valued in a way it can't be for anyone else. It's going to be too hard to get another job somewhere else because of perceived bias or real bias that might be out there. So attendance is better, the work quality is better, the loyalty is stronger. And so when you don't see that in your everyday experiences, there's a lot more myth or mysticism built up behind it, and it's rarely do we boldly and with passion accept those things we don't know. We often we're scared of things we don't know or understand. New experiences aren't always embraced with zest.
Paul Hannon, the Executive Director of Minds Action Canada, joins us to talk to us about how he thinks we are winning the war on landmine clearance and unexploded ordnance in the Global South.
Do a triage in terms of what the clearance needs are, and then start making sure you have enough donors and enough money to do that properly, and you train local people. You don't bring in a ton of expats. You don't bring in a ton of Canadians to do this, even if there may be Canadian military people who know how to do it. You bring in a trainer or two, and maybe a supervisor or two, and then you train the local people, who most of whom can't work anyways because the land is contaminated. So you're giving them employment. They have a motivation to clear the land because they want to live on it. And you're getting the community to rebuild itself. You're helping the community rebuild itself and clear itself. So that's, I think, a second main task you take. And the third task is that you have to help people understand, particularly the leadership and at the national and the local level, that people who have been victims of the weapon, landmine survivors, have rights, and it's not their fault.
I experienced the same thing as a teenager. I was able to keep the job, but it is that judgment, that visual judgment that is made, and having to overcome that judgment and prove the other person wrong that yes, you can do it, and you end up sort of doing a superhuman effort to over-impress because you feel that you're starting from a deficit position.
The war ended. A lot of people live in the poverty, that a lot of problems. So I'm happy work here with a lot of my friends, the landmine victim, to tell tourists about how Cambodian people that suffering in the war. I'm happy work here. I want to tell the youth generation of Cambodian, one day they grow up, don't go to the war, and tell all the tourists around the world that visit this museum should not make a war. I'm very glad to tell all the tourists here about all those happen, that they are very lucky because their country no war, no landmine, but they come to Cambodia, that Cambodia a lot of landmine. But now Cambodia is peaceful, no problem. Tourists can visit Cambodia, and Cambodia people open mind, open heart to tell what happened through Cambodia war.
So we have a whole pile of people to thank for this show. Richard Essler, who is the manager at the Siem Reap War Museum in Siem Reap, Cambodia. Please get out to see Richard and his guides and the museum if you get to that part of Cambodia in the near future. And to Tom or Kum, our very special guest who shared his part of his story with us. And of course, our panel of experts, Paul Hannon from Mines Action Canada, Noel Hutchinson from Asian Outreach International Canada, and Karen Valley, the director of War Amps National Amputee Center in Ottawa. And of course, our sound guy and all around good guy, show-like producer, Josh Nethledge from Mixed Media Sound. This show wouldn't have been possible without the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Thanks for joining us. My name is David Peck.
And that was part of a series of documentaries produced by CJSF a few years back. Hope you enjoyed that one. We have a bunch of other ones from that series. Anyway, thanks for tuning in today. That's about all the time we have for today's program. My name is Magnus Teeval. I've been your host for the hour. Democracy Now! Is coming up in about 30 seconds. And lots more great programming here, including Wandering Rhythms up at noon. Stay tuned and keep on listening to CJSF. Oh. All right, well, that didn't work. So, once again, thanks for listening. And not only will there be Democracy Now! Up in a few minutes, Wandering Rhythms at noon. Typically, Tuesdays is coming up at 3 p.m., and that's a show worth checking out. But right now, stay tuned for Democracy Now!